This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show. Trainers listen to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you with me for the next hour. As always, you are listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the program, and you're doing that through our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, with the Belmont Stakes being rescheduled for this coming Saturday, June 20th, I thought that it would be kind of fun to do something a little bit different on this edition of Trainer Talk. And rather than welcoming one trainer for the full hour to tell you their story and how they got started in the game and look back on some of their career highlights, I thought it would be fun to welcome several trainers. And we're going to do it with interview segments that we have already done here on Trainer Talk over the past several years. This program dates back about 8 years now, and you're going to hear from trainers who have won the Belmont Stakes. Some have done it in completely different fashions than others, and you're going to hear them looking back on those particular victories. And we're going to start with Hall of Fame trainer Nick Zito in the first half of the program, who has won the Belmont twice. You're going to hear from trainer David Carroll, who is now an assistant trainer to Mark Cassie, who, of course, won the race last year. David, the longtime exercise rider for 1989 Belmont winner Easy Goer. You'll hear from Miguel Clement, the son of Christophe Clement. They won it in 2014 with Tonalist. Kelly Breen pulled off a 24-1 upset with Ruler on Ice in 2011, and you'll hear from him later in the first half of the program. Second half of the show, you'll hear from Mark Cassie. You'll hear from trainer Jimmy Barnes, the assistant to Bob Baffert, talking about winning the Triple Crown with American Pharoah in 2015. And we'll wrap it up with future Hall of Famer, I should say, Todd Pletcher, who has won the race three times and will be looking to add to that resume coming up on Saturday. All right, so a lot of things to get to. It's going to be a very, very busy program. Let's get right to it and welcome in Hall of Famer Nick Zito, who joined us on this program several years ago at Saratoga. He has won the race twice, Birdstone 2004, Detara 2008, both of those victories denying a Triple Crown. He talks about both of those memorable days, and he also spends a little time talking about Mary Lou Whitney. But Nick started, and I started, by asking him if maybe there was a small part of him that felt some remorse about ruining a Triple Crown.
Well, I think the first one, but, you know, you take a deep breath. And the reason I say that is, you know, look, you're not supposed to have a, like they say, a rooting section, you know, for certain people or this and that. But how could you not have rooting for the Chapmans and John Service? How could you not have root for those people? Mm-hmm. So, not saying that if you beat somebody, this, but I'm just saying they were special people. They really were. You know, Mrs. Chapman's a sweetheart, and John, he's a sweetheart, you know, John Surrey, classy guy, and good horse trainer, whatever. But then when I took a deep breath and all those seconds I had in the Belmont, you know what I mean? I said, you know what? God was waiting for this. And, you know, he was waiting for me because, as they say in a good book, you know, leave it to God and he'll get you through everything. And sometimes, you know, before honors humility and all those seconds and all those tough beats, Shrikey got beat a nose and Gopher Jim was second, and this one was second, and that one was second, you know, and this one was third, and this one was blocked, and this one was there. And then I got a chance to make history. And when I say that, think about this. Talk about a blessed guy, right? Okay. 120,000 people there. 33 million people, I think, watching. We were part of history, yeah. You know? And Mary Lou and John Henriksen, you know, her husband, my good friend, what can I say about her? You know, gratitude is her middle name. She is so gracious and was almost apologizing, you know?
Yeah.
And when you know, when they spoke to us, we kind of, you know, Bob Costas said whatever he said to me, and I said, I think the right things, but you have to move on and do your job. And I think the next one, Mike, when we beat the Tara beat
Big Brown.
Big Brown, I think that was like, well, that horse just didn't fire. We were on the lead. That's happened a lot of times. Lucas did it with Commendable. You go way back before you guys won. Sherlock paid 100 and whatever he paid.
Yeah.
And then all these long shots that do win. Even though Birdstone paid a big price, he won the Champagne as a two-year-old. You know what I mean? And he was a top horse, later winning the Belmont and later winning the Travers, which is a pretty good thing to do in New York. Champagne, the Belmont, the Travers, that's pretty good.
Yeah. He had trained so well up to the Belmont as well, and it wasn't surprising. I'll never forget that race as long as I live. There were so many things to remember about it, but I was standing there with the woman who would become my wife and Erin Wellman, who's now the president of Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners, and we were all we were actually in one owner's box. They couldn't get back to the box because there were so many people. I don't know where they watched the race from,
right.
But we were in one of the owner's boxes watching the race, and Erin said to me, "Who's that moving on the turn?" And I said, "It's Mrs. Whitney's horse," because I had my binoculars and I could see that, you know, horses look like ants at Belmont Park.
That's right.
I could see the colors. Eaten blue and brown, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw him moving, and I just knew at that point, probably midpoint on the turn, that you were going to win the race. I mean, there was just no way they were going to stop him, you know? And it was amazing. And then how silent the crowd got afterwards.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
It was like a library in Belmont.
That's
Park.
A very good point. I'll tell you why. There were so many people from the Philadelphia area coming down rooting for Smarty Jones and young kids and teenage kids and everybody, you know. And I think maybe because I was a New York guy, a New York trainer, you know, and the Whitneys and whatever, that it wasn't as bad as it would have been if somebody else beat them.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So we're very proud of that. Peb did a cartoon of us, and it said Wanted, and he had a picture of me and whatever. And Philadelphia newspaper, like, you know?
Yeah.
And that was kind of funny. Yeah. It was funny.
Well, Mrs. Whitney, you brought her up. I mean, how gracious a lady.
Oh,
you know,
God.
She was here over the weekend for the Whitney Stakes. And talk about your relationship with her and what she means to the game.
Oh, my God. Thank you for bringing that up, dude. What could you say? I mean, the best way I could put it and just sum it up real quick is this. You know how every year... I've been saying this. This is the third time I said this publicly. Every year, you got to elect the president 4 years. And it would be fitting if every year we elected an American queen for us to be an advisor for the president. She would easily win. And maybe next year, 4 years, be Susan Lucci.
Her sidekick.
Yeah, sidekick. But the good thing is she brings so much to the table of everything you want. She is a servant. I mean, she is a public servant. She serves. You know, she may be a Whitney, and she may be Mary Lou Whitney, but she serves the people, and the people love her. She does things that, you know, I love this phrase in the good book about a widow. And Jesus talks about, you know, how people have so much money, so they give so much. And he says, tells his, you know, apostles that, look how much money they gave, but they have that. But look at this poor widow, came and gave 2 pence, that's all she had. Well, Mary Lou has wealth, but she gives everything she has.
Yeah.
She's at the back stretch feeding those people. She's hospitals. She donates to this. She gives. She is a wonderful, wonderful lady, and I am so proud and so happy to have met someone like that in my life. And her wonderful husband, John Henriksen, who's become my good friend. And I can say that, because not everybody starts off as good friends. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
And we're like brothers. And I can tell you, you know, they're two of the best people you'll ever meet. And let me tell you something, too. Get this right in, you know, on my favorite radio show. When they had nobody up here, she brought the day show up here. Before Saratoga was just, you know, the Saratoga and they did that. She was the one that said, no, we need to do more. And all those things that she had in the casino, you know, with the parades that she would have, and she'd have all those parties and, you know, all the celebrities there. And what would she do with that money? Give it to charity.
Yeah.
So she's a great lady, and thanks for asking.
Hall of Famer Nick Zito, wonderful comments on Mary Lou Whitney. That interview was done at Saratoga back in 2013 with myself and my co-host Jude Feld. Had a lot of fun with Nick and remembering Mary Lou Whitney, who passed away July 19th of last year. Well, trainer David Carroll, who was the exercise rider for Easy Goer when he won the Belmont in 1989, also knows a thing or two about breaking up a Triple Crown. And he reflected on his time with New York's Easy Goer.
Just brings back special memories. First of all, you know, he's a special horse, trained by a special man in Chug and owned by Mr. Phibbs. We had Sunday Silence, trained by the Eagle, Mr. Whittingham, just a tremendous trainer, owned by Arthur Hancock. And there was just so much rivalry at the time, West Coast versus East Coast. And it just brings back how racing was, how racing should be, great breeders, great trainers, and, you know, deciding everything on the racetrack.
Do you remember the first time that you actually sat aboard Easy Goer?
Oh, I do, yes. It was actually at Gulfstream when he came in initially. He had come down from Camden, and he was kind of beautiful colt, number one. He was very heavy set. We knew at the time that he wouldn't, you know, probably run till the summer or late fall at the time. But never knew, or never, with his pedigree, you'd always hope that he'd become the horse he did. But at the time, he just looked like a nice, well-bred horse, and hopefully would turn out to be a good horse, which he actually did.
Yeah, very good horse. I tell the story a lot that he's the horse that I credit for getting me hooked on the sport of racing. I went to the Traverse in 1989, sat at the picnic tables at the top of the stretch, and had a $2 across the board ticket on Easy Goer. I remember he was a heavy favorite. He won so easily that day, and I just fell in love with him. He was my first horse crush, if you want to look at it like that.
No, he had that effect on people and anyone that was around him, but he just had this charisma about him. And look at, he's just a terrific horse. And I kind of spent over 2 years with him every single day, riding him, traveling with him, and he was a huge part of my life, and he is to this day.
For those of us who have never had the privilege to be aboard a horse, and a horse the caliber of Easy Goer at that, describe what it's like to sit aboard a really good horse and to work or to gallop a really good horse like that.
They're just completely different, Mike, just from your average horse, from just sitting on them, how to carry themselves, how to move, the power, how easy to do things. And special horses know they're special too, and they just have that charisma about them, how to walk around the barn, how to carry themselves, how that look in their eye. And it's just like getting into a Ferrari, really. You can feel the power, and it's just different. And sometimes it's very hard to articulate exactly how it feels. But when you get up, you don't get that feeling very often. But when you do, it's very, very special.
You were aboard him early in his three-year-old season, and there was a work at Gulfstream Park that Shug thought was a little faster than it should have been. And I think Easy Goer made it look very, very easy. He wasn't too happy with you after that workout, if I recall. What do you remember about that and what you said to him?
The breeze you're referring to was actually the final breeze for the Kentucky Derby. Yes, and we were the breeze a half mile. Mr. Phibbs, Pat Tay, and Shug went over to the front side. I was told to go 48, 49, and that's what I did. But there was a horse about three off the rail, Monty Graves, who's now the pony girl for us at Churchill. But as soon as I got to the 3-8 pole, her horse kind of accelerated with her. So we kind of worked in tandem all the way around. I didn't think anything of it. My horse worked beautiful. Didn't bother me at all. But it obviously bothered Chug because it was his final breeze. He didn't want any mishaps to happen. But it's just one of those things that you know, I couldn't stop and start all over again. But I worked the time I was supposed to work, and, you know, the horse came out of the breeze beautifully. But there was a lot of pressure on Chug, and I can understand why he acted the way he did.
Yeah, and it's a situation where the horse just did everything so easily that maybe he could kind of fool some people at times, couldn't he?
Oh, yeah, and good horses will go faster than you actually think they're going. In this particular case, I knew him so well by then. I always got my times pretty right with him, and because I'd always go a little bit slower than I felt he should be going, just because I knew he was doing good times. But no, he worked beautifully that morning. But, you know, unlike these days where you have an 8:30 to 8:45 break for the Belmont or for the Derby and Oaks horses, he didn't have that at the time. So the track would rather get busy.
As somebody that was so close to Easy Goer, you mentioned spending all that time with him, being aboard him every morning like that. Take me through your emotions and what you remember about those three races throughout the Triple Crown.
Well, it's my first real experience with the Kentucky Derby. I had Seeking the Gold the year before. I got to ride him, and he ran against the winning colors and ran a nice race that year. But this was the first time over the winter we knew we had a special horse in our hands, and we got beaten in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile by Is It True on an off track. And but all winter, his preparation went really, really well. The Gotham was a special race. The Wood Memorial was a very good race, but I still believe he holds the record for the mile, 1:32.2 for the Gotham. But there's such build up at the time going for the Derby for Mr. Phibbs, you know, the Hancocks, and it was just a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. But it was just a magical time as well. And each day was, as we got closer, the pressure built for that. But going into the Derby, we went in there with an awful lot of confidence. His wood race is very good. We shipped in. He trained really well. Sun of Silence came from the West Coast after the Santa Anita Derby. We thought he had what we felt was a pretty hard race in that race, Pathfinder's Willem. So, you know, we were going in there with a lot of confidence, and rightfully so. And believing went off the favorite. But unfortunately, we had an off track at the time. We had two horses in that race, and never really traveled in the race. He never traveled with any kind of confidence at all. Never seemed to get a hold of it. And never really at any time did we think he was going to win the Derby. But it was just his class and courage that got him to finish second. So that was very disappointing. So we came out of that race. He came out of the race well. Went back to Belmont just for the week. He left Belmont on the Sunday prior to the Preakness, so I traveled down in the van with him. Spent that week with him. And each day he got better as well. He came out of that race really good. We were very confident going into the Preakness, and that was one of the best races I've ever been a part of, seen. But it was heartbreaking at the same time. And Pat Day, who was one of the greatest riders of all time and one of the greatest people of all time, and he will tell you this himself, that if he was to ride a race again or take one ride back, that would be the race he would take back, because I felt we had the best horse on the day. So now we're after coming off two disappointing defeats. Felt like we hadn't shown the world how good this horse really was. A lot of press media, obviously, a lot of huge build-up. Now we go back to Belmont. Sun of Silence is coming to our home turf. He's going for the Triple Crown. And Easy Goer, as soon as he got back to Belmont, that was back home for him. Big Sandy, he loved the track, and he just trained phenomenally. He just really just blossomed. He just had that air about him. We grew more confident as well. Shug was never lost, and Shug to this day, it's one of the things I admire him about, never lost confidence in the horse, never lost confidence in himself, and how he was getting this horse prepared. And just the last week going into the Belmont, we all felt like, no one ever actually just said it, but we all felt like, yeah, this is going to be our day. And on the walk over with the Belmont, you know, Shug, he's a man of few words, but he walked over and he just said to us, I think we're going to see something special today. And boy, we did.
Yeah, we certainly did. What was the feeling? You mentioned him blossoming when he got to Belmont Park and got back home. What was the feeling you had underneath you in those 3 weeks between the Preakness and the Belmont that was maybe a little bit different?
Oh, he was getting stronger. He was getting sharper. He was getting more a little tougher to gallop. All of those signs were like, wow, this horse is really sharpened up. He's getting stronger. He's putting more into what he's doing, and you could just tell he was a big horse. So, not saying he wasn't fit for the Preakness or Derby, he certainly was. But you could just tell that he was coming into his own, and he was just he was breeding different there at the time.
Yeah, you mentioned that heartbreaking defeats in the Derby and in the Preakness and the disappointment there. When you come back home to the Belmont and you're trying to deny Sunday Silence the Triple Crown, what was the mentality and the mindset from your perspective? Was it, geez, I have to find a way to get past this? Or was it more like a Rocky Balboa type thing? I'm going to train. I'm going to do everything with this horse. We're going to get locked in and we're going to take care of business here when he comes to our house.
It was, when you have a horse of this magnitude, you feel a responsibility to the horse and obviously to the owners, but you feel a responsibility to the horse to show the world how good we all felt. We all knew he was. So there was no stone left unturned for him. But we just trained him the way he would normally. He didn't change anything. The horse was actually doing it by himself. You know, he was just getting bigger, getting stronger, getting sharper. And we didn't go in there. At least my mindset wasn't, I need to beat Sunday Silence. It wasn't that at all, which obviously we did. We're going to deny him the Triple Crown. But it was just for the horse himself. We wanted the horse to win, to show for him. He deserved to win it, and we wanted it for him. And that was the greatest thing about the race. Shug never once said we got to beat him. No, obviously you have to beat him to win it. But it was all about the horse, and he just wanted the horse. He wanted this classic for the horse, and it just meant so much. And we were so proud of the horse. I mean, it was unbelievable, Mr. Winningham. You couldn't ask for a nicer man to be around. After the Derby, I always remember him coming over to see us. We were in the tack room, Shug and Tony Reinstadler, and he just knocked on the door and he came in and he just congratulated us on our horse. He just said, you know, his horse is a very, very good horse, but just congratulating on us, wishes the best for the Preakness. Just a class man, absolutely class man. And that was great. That was going on at the time. It was just a great rivalry, but it was done with class, and it was all about just getting your horse to perform the best on the day. Two tremendous trainers, two great owners, and two great horses, and that's what racing's all about. And it was just very, very special.
That's trainer David Carroll, and again, the exercise rider for Easy Goer. Wonderful comments there from David. Well, another tandem who played spoiler in the 2014 Belmont, when California Chrome was hoping to join Racing's Immortals, was the father-son team of Christophe Clément and Miguel Clément. And Miguel joined me on Trainer Talk not long ago, and that was in 2014 with Tonalist. And Miguel remembers that very special day.
It was, without a doubt, the best racing day of my lifetime. It was fantastic. It was a classic race, as you know. It probably broke a little bit our mold of only being a turf training outfit. I was very rewarding for my dad and the whole stables. You know, he had staff, the key guys have been there for years and years with my dad. You know, Christophe Loriot has been there from the very beginning, as well as many of our key foremen. And it was great. It was a great win. To be honest, we didn't actually quite know we won the race, first off, because we were a bit behind the finishing line. And it was so loud because it was the year of California Chrome. I believe there was a huge crowd that day. And from our angle, we thought we just missed. It looked like Joel just got there just too late and got commissioned to beat us on the rail. So to be completely honest, my dad might have said a few things, you know, right after the race, thinking we got, you know, just missed by a stride. And of course, no one ever heard that or even knew that, because I think the whole press was focused on California Chrome and then Steve Coburn's remarks after the race. So I'm a bit lucky in that regard. But it was a terrific day. He was a great horse. You know, he won four grade ones from mile to mile and a half. And he never missed a beat, that horse. So no, it was a great, great special day.
When you're coming into a Belmont Stakes like that, you're the underdog. There's a horse going for a Triple Crown. What's the feeling like in the approach on your end?
No. He was not the underdog. I mean, people say he might have been the underdog, but if you knew the horse, you went very impressively the Peter Pan, the only time, you know, he won his maiden incredibly impressively at Gulfstream. Then he came back, he ran second in allowance at Gulfstream, and we were devastated. In that race, it turned out to be Constitution won the race. Tonelius ran second, and fourth was Wicked Strong. I mean, who would have guessed that the first, second, and fourth place finishers were those three horses in an allowance at Gulfstream? So I think we might have just picked the hardest, you know, allowance that ever took place at Gulfstream that day. Then he came back. He was supposed to run in the wood, but had a bit of a hiccup. And then he came back in the Peter Pan instead, which was annoying because we missed the Kentucky Derby. But he romped in the Peter Pan. And from that point onwards, he always showed he was a, you know, different class. He's never missed a beat, and he ran as a three-year-old and four-year-old, never ducked anybody, and ran in all the biggest races year-round. So that was great.
I love the
but
way...
before the race, no, we thought he was going to run big. Was he going to get up or not? I couldn't tell you honestly, but we were sure he was going to at least run big.
You know, I love the way you just defended your player, too, when I said that about being the underdog coming into that race. Because I've always said, if you're a trainer, you better defend your player, right? If your horse is going into a big race, you better have the confidence to come out and back that horse and back that ownership group that you're training for.
Yeah, no, I agree. Listen, he was, it's all about defending yourself, I suppose. I suppose Tonelius, everyone called him a Belmont horse. I was happy he won, you know. Yeah, everyone forgets he broke his maiden very impressively at Gulfstream, and he also won, I think at the time it's called the Cigar Mile or the New York Mile, which is at Aqueduct. You know, he was just pigeonholed maybe as a Belmont specialist, but he won Grade Ones from a mile to a mile and a half, and he won big races, you know, at many different racetracks. And I suppose it's no different than, for instance, my dad, who's probably pigeonholed or labeled as a turf trainer. I suppose it's great that you're labeled as something good, but I think our stats would kind of defend that. He's, you know, very capable of winning races on turf or dirt or polytrack from two-year-olds all the way to, you know, nine-year-olds. That's pure sensation as a nine-year-old at the moment. From 5 furlongs on grass to a mile and a half on dirt, it's, I think the stats are okay, to be honest.
Miguel Clement looking back on Tonelius win in 2014. We are handling the show a little bit differently for you, a Belmont Stakes edition. Several trainers looking back on their huge wins in what is the test of the champion, a little bit different structure here in 2020. Don't forget, we'll have coverage for you coming up this Saturday, 3 to 6 Eastern, 3 to 4:30 with undercard coverage, 4:30 to 6, the Belmont Stakes portion of the show. You can head over to horseracingradio.net to check out the podcast or check out our entire listing of affiliates and SiriusXM channel information to find out where you can tune in to the Belmont Stakes. All right, second half of the program, we'll continue to look back on the Belmont. We'll do it with trainers Kelly Breen, Mark Cassie, Jimmy Barnes, and Todd Pletcher. That's all ahead on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're going to have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical, and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
Live racing is back at Woodbine. Visit Woodbine.com to watch live feeds and check out their Stellar Stakes program, which includes $13.8 million in purses across 75 stakes. The Canadian Triple Crown begins with the 161st running of the Queen's Plate on Saturday, September 12th. The Grade 1 Rico Woodbine Mile, a win in your end for the Breeders' Cup, is set for Saturday, September 19th. Visit Woodbine.com for more information. Woodbine, a new breed of experience.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. she won the Phipps in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Pin Oak Studs Alternation is a top 10 third crop sire by earnings, black type winners, and graded stakes winners. With nearly $7 million in earnings to date, Alternation was represented by six black type horses in 2019. From a second crop, three-year-old daughter Serengeti Empress won the 2019 Grade 1 Kentucky Oaks and was runner-up in both the Grade 1 Test and Acorn Stakes. Serengeti Empress finished the year with a strong third to older mares in the Breeders' Cup Distaff and is a finalist for Eclipse Champion three-year-old filly. By Distorted Humor, millionaire graded stakes winner Alternation stands at Pin Oak Stud.
Hello, I'm Michael Blowen, founder of Old Friends Thoroughbred Retirement Farm. One of our highest priorities for these living legends is safety. That's why the fence we trust most at Old Friends is the V-Mesh Keepsake from Red Brand. Keepsake features a V-Mesh weave to prevent hooves from getting caught, and the mesh design flexes on impact. Learn more about the quality, safety, and long-lasting value of Keepsake V-Mesh Horse Fence by visiting redbrand.com.
Join HRRN in partnership with NBC Sports Audio for our exclusive coverage of the Belmont Stakes this Saturday, beginning at 4:30 p.m. Eastern. Plus, undercard coverage beginning at 3 p.m. Eastern. It's the first leg of the 2020 Triple Crown. The Belmont Stakes on HRRN, presented by TwinSpires.com and Red Brand Fence. Go to HorseRacingRadio.net for more information or to listen live.
Hi, I'm Leah Jarmati, and I love listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back. Mike Penna with you on a somewhat different, somewhat special edition of the program, looking back on so many of the memorable moments in Belmont Stakes history and doing it with trainers who have appeared on this program to talk about their Belmont horses over the years. And we turn our attention now to trainer Kelly Breen, who in 2011 sent out 24-1 long shot Ruler on Ice to get the victory. And he reflected on exactly what made that day so memorable.
One of the best things for me, and being from New Jersey, was that a lot of my family was there. My mother has been sick. She couldn't make it, but my father made it. My brother made it. My sister made it. And they're not usually, not to say fans, but they don't come to big races. Or, you know, when I went to the first time I went to the Kentucky Derby, it was a bigger deal for, you know, locals from New Jersey to go to Kentucky for the Kentucky Derby. So part of it was my family. The other part of it was, you know, I think going back to gambling was that we all bet on them. You know, it wasn't like we went in there and said, now we have a long shot and let's, you know, keep our fingers crossed. We went in there and I told everybody, you know, it was, we got out of the paddock and George says, what do you think? I says, George, I bet. And I'm sure my pocket money is with my wife around. He's like, really? And I said, yeah. And, you know, I get an opportunity about twice or three times a year where I tell my wife that I'm going to make a little wager that she gets me spending money. So with 10 minutes to post, George handed me a knot of money, and he says, bet for me, too. So I think part of saying that you're going to do it, running in a big race, doing it, cashing a ticket, having your family there, you know, a Triple Crown race, it could have been a beer commercial, but it didn't get much better than that.
And if I recall, you cheered so hard you had to go to the doctor afterwards, right?
I lost my voice for about, I'm going to say, 6 weeks.
Wow.
I was waiting for it to come back, and when it never came back, the local doctor that we have at Horse at Monmouth Park, Angelo Chinichi, he says, I'm going to send you to a specialist. He says, you really sound like crap. So when I did go to the specialist, and the guy says, you know, your vocal cord, the thing is vocal cord goes down and looks like the point of a piece of paper. He says, yours is as round as a bowling ball. So he says, you're going to need some medication, some anti-inflammatories, some prednisolone, so-and-so. And he says, and try not to talk. I said, yeah, not that easy.
Kelly Breen. Funny stuff talking about that win in 2011 with Ruler on Ice. You know, Mark Cassy has had so many big moments in this sport, including last year with Sir Winston when he won the Belmont. And you remember, he also had Preakness winner War of Will in that race, which made the victory last year somewhat bittersweet.
That was a strange moment. It didn't surprise me at all that Sir Winston won. We'd been saying all week long that he was sitting on an extremely good race. It was emotionally, a lot of people looked at me and said, you know, you just didn't seem as happy. But the best way to describe that is if you have two kids, right?
Yeah.
So I have my two children there. One just accomplished one of the greatest feats of all time for us. And the other one kind of had a bad day. And so you want to be happy for your one son or daughter, and then you feel bad for your other one. So it was a little bittersweet.
Yeah.
I was so happy for the farmers because they're wonderful people and they deserve it. And I was happy for Sir Winston. But in the same time, I was sad for War of Will and sad for Gary Barber. So, it was an entirely different feeling than the Preakness.
You know what struck me as being somewhat interesting and a little bit different? You win two classic races, two-thirds of the American Triple Crown, and neither owner is there to accept the trophy with you for either race. Did you ever think that would happen?
Yeah, two different deals. Luckily, Tracy's feeling better now. He was just a little under the weather.
Yeah.
And as we know with Gary, he does have a day job, and I often say, okay, don't quit your day job because we need the day job.
That's been a great relationship, Gary Barber and yourself. You go back a long way. Tell me about that relationship and how that started.
It's kind of crazy. You just, you go back through your life and see how little things can mean so many. So I had a horse called Patriotic and Proud. Aaron Wellman bought all of him from me. I owned part of him from Eclipse. And at the time, then Gary Barber bought a piece of him, and we had some success. He was a pretty nice horse. One day Gary called me and introduced himself and said, I'd like to be a little more prominent in Canada. And I said, well, that sounds good to me. And we've had just amazing, amazing success. He's a great guy too, we talk pretty well every day. He thinks out of the box. We're fortunate. If you look at a horse like Sir Winston, and his career, we took some crazy shots where a lot of owners wouldn't even let me run him in the races. I mean, I can still remember our conversation, Tracy and I. He had won the display here at Woodbine, and we were sitting in Ocala, and I said to Tracy, we could go up and run in the Withers on the dirt. I said, but he may get beat 40 lengths. As long as you're okay with that, I said, because I can't tell you whether he's going to run good or bad. He's an extremely different type of horse to train. And he goes, I'm good with it. Let's try it. And we did that, and he ran well, and it led to other things. But there's what the old saying, if you're afraid to step off first, you can't steal second. So a lot of times, that's what we're doing. And that's probably why you'll never see me be a high percentage trainer. But I also believe there's a lot of horses out there that wouldn't be where they were if I was that trainer, because I will. One thing about me, I'll run them, and I always say they're like puzzles. You have to keep trying the pieces. A lot of times the pieces don't fit, and when they don't fit, you go on to another piece. And that's my philosophy, and it's worked very well for me.
Yeah, we started by Yeah, it's Mark Cassie. Looking back on Sir Winston and that win last year and his relationships with the owners, he's just had so much success in this game. And my thanks to Mark for visiting with us there. Trainer Jimmy Barnes, well, he was part of a historic run in 2015 with American Pharoah. The assistant to Hall of Famer Bob Baffert reflected on every detail of that historic accomplishment.
Fans just overwhelmed us there. They were just came out in droves. It was just been amazing, the fan support we've had with this horse. And, you know, every day you do think about it. And, you know, I'm trying to think of moving back to California now. We're packing. I've got to get my mind on the two-year-old and start looking for our next Kentucky Derby horse next year.
Isn't that the great part about this game? It doesn't stop, right? It's kind of just a cycle that continues on.
No, yeah, you know, I like to, I'd like to just stop and this would be it, but oh no, we have to move on. You know, we're already preparing for next year right now. So, you know, it's just been great. You know, it's a thrill, something you'll remember the rest of my life just to cherish and, you know, just wonderful.
How much time have you been able to spend reflecting maybe on your life and where you started and now where everything ends up with this unbelievable accomplishment?
Well, you know, I do spend time. I've done that for quite some time because up until this point, I thought I'd been done quite a bit and had a lot of accomplishments, but this is just over the top, this accomplishment. And, you know, I always knew once I started working for Bob, I knew we had a chance. We were going to do it. If anyone was going to do it, we could do it. We have the caliber of horse to do it. And, you know, we've been close. The 1 year I was just very disappointed with Point Given because I really thought that was the horse that could have done it, and we couldn't win the Derby. And the Derby's, to my opinion, the toughest race of the three to win. It's so hard just to get there and survive the races just to get up to it, and then to, you know, get through the 20 horse field. And but you know, once we won the Derby, hell, the Preakness, for some reason, the Derby, who, if you run good in the Derby, you run good in the Preakness usually. And you know, Belmont's tough also, but that Derby, to me, is the toughest one of all. Probably the most ever, a lot of people will say, well, was it stressful? Not really stressful. The Derby's probably more stressful than anything just because it's so large. You have to deal with a large crowd, large field. It's a big walk over. The paddock's insane. It's just a lot for your horse to have to comprehend.
Put this Triple Crown in perspective for me then, Jimmy. Where does it rank among all-time sporting feats?
Well, I mean, you know, I would have to think it's right up near the top. It's hard to compare, you know, the horses with athletes, you know, as far as Super Bowls and World Series. But it's something that's tough to do, and you know, a lot of people said it might not be done again.
Yeah, it's certainly one of those accomplishments in the world of sport that really doesn't take a backseat to any other sport when you look at their milestone performances, whether it be the Triple Crown in Major League Baseball or accomplishments that we see in the NBA with averaging a triple-double for a full season. That's only been done one time. The horse racing Triple Crown is certainly right up there. Take me back to about 7 p.m. on the first Saturday in June and tell me about what was happening in the moments before the race, and then take me through watching him in that mile-and-a-half journey.
Well, you know, the main thing was just, you want to get through the paddock. You want your horse comfortable. From what I could see, we came, it's a short walk over there, which was nice. He went through the paddock, saddled very easily. It was very good. This horse really cooperates. He makes it easy on himself. Went through watching him, you know, I'd keep an eye on him at all times. Watching him in the post parade, he was handling the post parade great. He looked awesome. He had a bounce to his step and looked good. Really, it was about mainly getting my family together, finding a spot to watch the race, because I can't be too far away in case, you know, I'm needed for something. So I try to stay close to the rail up front. We get a spot usually like right behind the winner's circle. I know going to the gate, the main thing, we got to get out of the gate. You got to break. You don't want to have to overcome anything. You don't want to have to, you know, get behind the eight ball immediately and just have to overcome something. So the break was most important. He broke. Once he broke and got to the lead, you know, and they were clicking off fractions that's his like work pace when he works. He works faster than he was running. And nobody was pushing him. I knew we were in pretty good shape. But it is, you know, it's a mile and a half.
The distance really didn't concern me too much. I think what makes this horse a little special is he's got a high cruising speed. He really cruises, and he'll keep going. You know, he doesn't stop. If you go with him early, you're going to run fast, and he'll wear you out. And if you try to catch him, he doesn't stop, so you're going to wear yourself out trying to catch him. But watching the race, you know, when the fractions are going, I'm enjoying it. I know we're pretty comfortable. His ears are pricked and everything. So turning for home, I said, well, we got this now. You know, this it's in the bag. So I stood back and I watched my family. I had my two daughters with me and my wife. And, you know, watching them root for the horse really was enjoyment for me because my children, they don't get to go to all the races. They've been, you know, to quite a few, but this will be their first for the Triple Crown race. And, you know, just watching them root for this horse was really enjoyment for me.
Who was more emotional, you or the kids or Dana?
Dana probably was. I think Dana was. Yeah, I looked over at her and George Alvarez, our exercise rider. They started crying about the 16th bull. And, you know, I held everything in pretty good. I was, you know, I'm emotional, but, you know, I just wanted to get out on the track and receive him and just greet him when he came back.
When did it?
That was something else. That was spectacular. There were so many people there that day.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And the roar just went on and on for a good 10 to 15 minutes.
The winner's circle was insane. The whole thing was so over the top. And it was just, it's a feeling, you know, I'll never forget. And I can bring it back in any moment, in my, you know, just sitting here thinking about it, reflecting on it.
When did all that emotion finally hit you?
You know, then and later, you know, just whenever I think about it, I can get a little emotional about it. But, you know, we come back to work and, you know, we have other horses to run and, you know, you have to just kind of move on. And, you know, I always keep it with me and, it's hard to forget it because you got so many people coming. I'll bring people into the barn and they start crying, just looking at the horse. It's amazing.
How much sleep did you get that night?
So many people's day. Seattle Slews rider here was here the other day, Gene Perget, and I let him get up on the horse and walk around the barn, and I almost made him cry.
You let him get up on American Pharoah?
Absolutely.
How do you like that?
I put him up in the barn. He walked around the shed three times, and then we took him out front, took some pictures with him on him, and then he hopped off, and I put our regular exercise on, went and galloped him, and came back. I let him lead him back off the racetrack back into the barn. I made his day. He was happy.
How much sleep did you get that night after the race?
Well, not a whole lot because the worst part of it, we were leaving the next morning, so they picked up tack at 6 a.m. and picked up the horses at 7:30, so I didn't have a whole lot of time to, you know, we were out till 1 or 2 in the morning. But we get some rest after that once we get back to Churchill.
You know, Bob mentioned a couple of times throughout the week and then right after the race that one of the reasons he was so emotional was because he was reflecting back on his parents that had passed away. They were always there by his side and always cheering for him. You kind of had that same moment looking back on your dad, Laverne, who passed away, what, 15 years ago?
You know, growing up as a child, I'd always worked for his trainer. During the summer, I'd travel the fair circuit and you know, from 8 years old on, I was, you know, they're cleaning stalls, were walking hot, started galloping at 13. You know, we were always, you know, he trained horses early when I was really young. So it goes back a long ways to the early 60s, even into the late 50s. Those memories come back. And I know, I told her, you know, I'm not going to be – this was back in – I think it was after we won the Arkansas Derby. I told him I'm not going to be able to – you know, I'll call you as much as I can, but you're probably not going to hear from me too much because I'm on a mission. I'm going to win the Triple Crown this year. She said, well, okay, just try to win the Derby first. So, I knew early on we had a special horse. What made it so easy for me was the horse made it easy, you know. I think the real – The reason why it was so easy, you know, this horse had some time off after he never ran in there, didn't get to run in the Breeders' Cup. We had a little injury come up, so we needed 60 days off. And once he got his 60 days, then it was trying to start to train him. So we had to, you know, we're looking, where are we going to start? Okay, well, we'll start in the Rebel. Well, we only have from you know, like we only had like 2 months to get him ready, in which he really cooperated with that. He was, you know, straightforward. There was no setback. You know, we just marched right ahead and ran him in the Rebel. He just ran off the chart that day. He just, you know, it's pouring down rain, slop. But once we got started there, we had a fresh horse. He ran again back in the Arkansas Derby. Really didn't take much out of him there. The race that really, I think, got him ready for the rest of the series was the Derby. You know, a lot of people were kind of disappointed. They thought he should have ran off the screen. But, you know, looking back, the best horses in the whole series basically were Firing Line and Dortmund. They were probably the California horses were the toughest horses this year. And, you know, he hadn't really gone to the bottom of himself in the early races. That race really got him ready when he beat Firing Line at Dortmund that day here. And then it was a matter of just keeping him happy and fresh and getting up to Baltimore. And the rains came down and he got another easy race and over that fast track. And then we had 3 weeks to prepare for the Belmont. And that was, you know, he came out of the Preakness so well that it was very easy for me. I never had the day where I had to, you know, I never had to miss training. There was no complications. So he made it very easy for me. And I think that's really what it takes to win this. It's all about timing. Timing is everything.
Talking with Jimmy Barnes, longtime assistant to Hall of Fame trainer Bob Baffert here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jimmy, you just mentioned the rains coming down before that Preakness Stakes. And, of course, we were there providing the coverage on the network, and it was an absolute monsoon. And they kept all the horses out there on the turf course as you were saddling. I can only imagine what that was like. What was that like for you?
NBC, it's all about their timing. And, you know, we were the one and two, so I'm with the woman from ABC. I'm with the paddock judge who gives the riders a leg up. And I kept telling the woman, hey, we got to go. It's going to rain. It's coming now. It's coming. And she said, no, we got to wait. We got to wait. We got to wait. And I said, hey, we better go. And she said, no. And then a few seconds later, it started raining pretty hard. And then they gave us the go ahead to the leg up. And that was, by the time we got them on the track, it was a monsoon. The wind was blowing and everybody was scattering. Well, now I couldn't make it back across to the grandstand, so I'm looking for a place to watch the race from. And it's raining hard, as you well know. So I saw an open door in the back of the tote board. So at this point, I'm just looking for cover because it was raining and the wind was blowing so hard. So it probably wasn't the smartest thing to do to jump in the tote board with all the electrical wires and everything. But I was just standing there, and I'm thinking, oh, this is great. We're going to win the Preakness, and they're not going to find me. I'm going to get electrocuted. They'll find me 3 days later in the tote board. But I spotted another open door, and that's with NBC's office or little headquarters where they had a television monitor, and I dashed up into there and watched the race from there. But it was something else.
Yeah, it was something else. It was like nothing I've ever seen, and obviously it worked out for the best, and everything in all three races worked out perfectly, and here we are looking at the first Triple Crown winner.
It's all the timing, just everything. You know, it was weird training this horse here at Churchill. It would rain and rain and rain, and whenever we go out, it stopped raining. Bob came, he goes, oh, I'm worried about working or not. It's all right. He likes the off track, so don't worry about that. He goes, but boy, it's raining hard. And just as 8:30 would come and it was time to go breeze him, just the rain stopped. We got our 10 minutes, worked him, got back to the barn. Here came the rain again. So for some reason, everything absolutely just worked out perfect.
We mentioned your wife,
which
Dana.
It usually doesn't. Usually you get something at some point in time with horses. Something goes wrong and you have to come up with another plan or something. But as long as I handled all the small technicalities, you know, making sure I got him to the paddock, making sure he was good in the gate. You know, that's a big deal in our program as a gate, because that's probably one of the most important parts. If we don't come from, you know, our horses break and they go, you got to pass us to beat us.
Well, Jimmy Barnes with a fantastic reflection on American Pharoah's Triple Crown in 2015, vanquishing that 37-year drought since Affirmed pulled it off. We'll wrap it up here with Todd Pletcher, who has won the Belmont three times. He'll look to add to his resume when he saddles Dr. Post in Farmington Road this coming Saturday. But
He's won it with Rags to Riches in 2007, the filly. He won it in 2013 with Palace Malice and in 2017 with Taprit. And he started talking about all three, but he started with the filly Rags to Riches because, hey, as they say, you never forget your first.
Yeah, I say to still to this date, that's the most exciting race that that we've won, and certainly you know, one for the ages. And just, you know, the way the whole thing unfolded, and the, you know, when she fell to her face leaving the gate and then was able to recover and, you know, and have a stretch long duel with Curlin that just, you know, we're bobbing back and forth. I can't imagine a more exciting scenario, and, you know, for a filly to be able to beat horses of that quality at, you know, at the true classic distance of a mile and a half. It was just, it was and still is just awesome to watch.
When you think about your other two, Palace Malice and Taprit, what things immediately come to mind?
Well, with Palace Malice, I mean, he was a horse that we felt was a little bit under the radar. You know, he hadn't had that breakthrough performance. He got in some trouble in the Louisiana Derby, kind of ran off on the front end with blinkers on in the Derby, in the sloppy, you know, in a sloppy track. But when he came back to Belmont, I mean, he was training lights out. And his couple of breezes leading up to it, we really felt like we were going in with a chance. So, you know, it was great to see him deliver, you know, that big performance that we felt like he had in him. But it was also, for me, especially gratifying because it was for Dogwood Stable and Mr. and Mrs. Campbell and the Orifices and everyone involved with Dogwood. It, you know, played a big role early in my career and gave me an opportunity when I desperately needed one. And so that was, you know, to be able to win a classic for them was special.
Yeah, he was. I said that too. I thought he was under the radar, but jumped up in a big way that day in 2013. You come back 4 years later with Taprit. You win it for a third time. What do you remember about that day?
It was a similar thing. You know, we came back. We employed pretty much the same kind of strategy that we had with Palace Malice. You know, brought him back to Belmont. He trained very well here. And then the one thing I remember about that particular race was just, you know, the way the race unfolded and kind of the position we were able to get early on and just, you know, having the entire game plan fall into place so perfectly. It just, that part of it felt great.
I'm sure they all felt great for trainer Todd Pletcher, three-time Belmont Stakes winner, and we'll see if he can make it four coming up this Saturday. A reminder that you can hear all of that coverage exclusively here on the Horse Racing Radio Network in partnership with NBC Sports Audio. We kick it off 3:00 Eastern Time on Saturday with our coverage of the undercard stakes races brought to you by Breeders' Cup. That comes up 3 to 4:30, 4:30 to 6:00. Is our Belmont Stakes portion of the show, and that's brought to you by Red Brand Fence and TwinSpires.com. You want to make sure you're locked in for 3 hours of Belmont Day coverage here on the Horse Racing Radio Network coming up this Saturday. Should be an awful lot of fun as we begin the 2020 Triple Crown in somewhat unorthodox fashion, but it is still a Triple Crown. You still have the Belmont, the Kentucky Derby is the second leg, and now the Preakness wrapping it up on October 3rd. Well, if you missed any portion of this particular show and our look back at so many of the top Belmont victories we've seen over the past many, many years, Nick Zito kicked it off in the first half of the show. Two-time Belmont winner, Birdstone 2004, Datara in 2008. He also spent time talking about Mary Lou Whitney, and that interview was done about 6 years or so before Mary Lou passed away. So some great comments there from Nick, and you won't want to miss it. Go back and check it out on the replay on the podcast of this show. David Carroll was with me as well. He spent time looking back on Easy Goer and his win in 1989. David was the exercise rider for Easy Goer, working with Shug McGahee, and that was a really special moment for him. Miguel Clement, the son of Christoph, talking about Tonalist winning it in 2014. You heard Kelly Breen with Upsetter Ruler on Ice in 2011. Mark Cassie looking back on Sir Winston last year. Jimmy Barnes Yeah, talking about the Great American Pharaoh in 2015, and Todd Pletcher just moments ago. My thanks to all of them who took time to join me over the past several years to make this show possible, and thanks to everyone who tuned in to this special edition on this Wednesday afternoon here today. For my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios, I'm Mike Penna. Join us Saturday for the Belmont Stakes. Go to horseracingradio.net to get more information. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.